It's a little different because we're not going to be reading a whole chapter or so out of the scriptures and then discussing that in detail. We're going to be looking at it more from a point of view of how to study or methods of study that are out there to help our knowledge to how we can better study the book. And that's what we're going to look at initially. And there is a plan. We'll eventually, as this series goes on, we'll get to some in-detail stuff in how we interpret some things in Revelation. But up front, I want to talk about some initial things. Before we really go there, though, at least first, I do want to read something out of the scriptures because I would feel very remiss if I did not. So, out of Revelation 22, and understand this is after all of those enigmatic visions, in Revelation 22, and John writes, "And he said to me, 'Do not seal up the words of the prophecy of this book, for the time is near. Let the evildoer still do evil, and the filthy still be filthy, and the righteous still do right, and the holy still be holy. Behold, I am coming soon, bringing my recompense with me, to repay everyone for what he has done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end.'" The Lord's Word. So, before going into the what we're going to do as far as a lesson, I wanted to start with a little bit of a testimony as far as where I'm coming from. And Mark, with you, if you would hit click. All right, watch this. Ah, you like that?
I need sound effects.
You like that? I do. I need some sound effects. But where am I coming from as I begin to preach and teach the book of Revelation? It's important. I mean, anytime I crack open something that's on this topic, I want to see where is this person coming from, because it gives me an idea of their mindset as they do the writing. So it's important that I put this. I'm going to kind of explain my journey to how I got to where I am, and as we go from here.
Is there going to be a fire and brimstone preaching?
No, you know, you've been here long enough, Paul, to know that I am not a fire and brimstone. Oh, you're talking about that. So I want to begin with a testimony. A little on my church background. I grew up in the PCA. 1974, my parents joined the PCA. I was 3 years old, that should tell you, how old I am there. But I was baptized in the Methodist Church, interestingly. But my parents went over to the PCA church. They had just broken away from the PCUS. It was in early 74. It was the first sermon of their brand new pastor at Trinity Presbyterian Church in Montgomery. And so I ended up growing up in that church. Dr. Robert J. Osteson was the pastor. If you go on my website, I've got 99 of his sermons posted if you want to listen to some of his stuff. But so I grew up, I would say, under good teaching, good solid teaching. Another place, later I went over to Eastwood Presbyterian Church in Montgomery. If some of y'all are familiar with that, I was under Aaron Fleming's teaching there. But basically, I was raised on Reformed, Covenantal preaching and teaching by some extremely gifted people. And as for eschatology, that is end times understandings, what I ingested from all of that was basically that Jesus could come again anytime. That was my eschatology. That was it. Jesus can come again anytime. Now, perhaps they spent a lot of time explaining all that, but that's what I got out of it. And I still hold to that position. If you understand anything, understand Jesus can come again at any time. Okay? So, fast forward, around 1999, 2000 time frame. Cher and I, we were at Fort Sill, in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. I was stationed there. And when we got there, we looked around for a church. And we particularly wanted to find a church that was going to be sound in biblical teaching. One is they were going to prop open the Bible. That was where they were going to be preaching from, teaching from, that kind of stuff. So we found, it's in the name, a Bible church. We visited several. We ended up going to this Bible church. Now, what we didn't know is that was code word for dispensational church. And we didn't know that. And in all honesty, I had no idea what dispensationalism was. I just had never, ever, just never, it was never brought up. You know, if it was, it just went way over my head, you know. So Mark, pay attention. You know, no, you're good. But, you know, dispensationalism, you cannot say when you are 30 years old that you've never heard of it. So you're good. It was around that time also that Sharon and I were exposed to the Left Behind series of books. And some of y'all may have read them. They're fascinating. I mean, they just draw you in. You're like, whoa. I mean, this idea of planes falling out of the sky because the pilots were raptured. I mean, whoa. it was a fascinating group of, frankly, science fiction books. But Sharon and I, we spent quite a bit of time. I mean, we spent days, like, just absorbed in these books. I mean, I'd pass you one and pick up another because we were like, wow, this stuff is incredible. But as we read them and discussed them, you know, it just came to it seemed like something was not really right there. I mean, we felt that there was just a lot that didn't fit, some things that were stretched, and I couldn't put my finger on it. I just didn't have the knowledge at the time, you know, but my hackles were up. So I started digging into dispensationalism, which I figured out was the theology behind the Left Behind books. And I was also triggered a bit by some of the things that the pastor at the church that we were going to then had said. And so I started comparing what was being said in these circles, in these books, with what I was raised on, this Reformed covenantal teaching of my youth. In the course of my trying to figure out what was what, I was forced to dig into what I was taught growing up. So I had to study that and figure out really what did I learn. And so I went into detail really looking at this, and it was a beautiful, wonderful time as the pieces fell into place for me. So I studied dispensationalism, and I also studied basically Reformed theology. And so I remember, you know, got a whole emailing my dad back home. So which do you hold? Do you think is right? Dispensationalism or Reformed theology? And he was like, huh? So he had to dig into that. You know, interesting course of discussions there that we ended up having. So as it was, through my studies and looking at these things, I ended up rejecting dispensationalism as being in serious error. And I won't go into all the details tonight why that was, but that was my conclusion. And along with it, I rejected their dispensational premillennialist eschatology. It did not fly. And I had stronger words to say, but I'm going to be nice. So as it was, I ended up searching. If all of that was out there and not correct, well, what was right? What was right? What did the Bible really teach about the end times? And so I began studying the major positions: historical premillennialism, postmillennialism, and amillennialism. All of these, by the way, have been held at various times, and you know, you could do a survey with some, you know, when the PCA first started, it was more historical premill guys, and now it's more amill guys, and you've had postmill guys kind of spread throughout the whole thing. So in the denomination, you've got all three of these views represented. So I'm like, well, which one's the good one? I mean, you know, what are you to think? So in my studies, I came across the writings of Keith Matheson. You may have heard of him. Keith Matheson, Lorraine Bettner, and Kenneth Gentry. And they all gave pretty persuasive arguments towards what's called the post-millennial position. And I started to lean heavily towards the post-mill position. We have somebody sitting over there that's at least his current position. At least that's what he said when he was standing up here before. You know, so I started leaning that way. And in particular, in my studies, I was influenced by this book called Before Jerusalem Fell by Kenneth L. Gentry. Now, he's been an Orthodox Presbyterian Church, a PCA pastor, and an RPC pastor. But he wrote that. That was his doctoral dissertation, which basically blows away the arguments against a late-date understanding of Revelation, which would be around AD 95. And it shows, convincingly, at least in my mind, that Revelation was written during the latter days of Nero's reign, about mid-AD 60. So this would have been before the destruction of Jerusalem. And so that was awesome. I can't even remember how I found that book. I mean, maybe just, I don't know, providentially somehow ended up in my hands. I really don't know, but it's a wonderful book that I highly recommend. And this, along with R.C. Sproul's, and a lot of y'all know who R.C. Sproul is, his book here called The Last Days According to Jesus, this was very helpful, very helpful. And this, so he talks a lot about the Olivet Discourse here, but that was also a very helpful book. So, the views basically put forward in both of those books, R.C. Sproul and Kenneth Gentry, because of the early dating, is called a partial preterist position. Not a full preterist, a partial preterist, also known as orthodox preterism, and hopefully we'll get there with that, what preterism means. That's part of what we want to talk about tonight. Or Adams, J. Adams, who wrote this book, he's the one who really has fought for the name orthodox preterism. Basically, it means that most of the prophecies in the book of Revelation were fulfilled in AD 70, in the fall of Jerusalem. Most. Some go further than that, but I'll just leave it at that. But now these terms, orthodox preterism, partial preterism, you know, this is in contrast to futurism. And a lot of what you see is Left Behind books, futurism. And this basically says that most of what's in Revelation is in our future, much less way in our past. So you've got way in the past versus way in the future, a couple of very different ways of understanding what Revelation is talking about. And as for me, the dating of Revelation was key for me coming to my position. I thought that the events of Revelation fit like a glove with the historical events leading up to the AD 70 destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. I mean, as you look at it, it's just like, whoa. I mean, at least that's the way I saw it and see it. It also seemed to fit Jesus' teachings of the Olivet Discourse like a glove, which I last few Sundays I spent on those. A lot of y'all were here for that. But so as I entered Covenant Seminary in 2002 to earn an MDiv, you know, I would have said going in there that I was a partial preterist, postmillennial, and that was my view. And actually, if anybody asked me, that's what I would have told them. However, after a few years at seminary, my views changed. And so there's a theme here. Our views can change. It's okay. You know, it's okay for us to get more info and adjust our views on that. Matter of fact, I think that's responsible to do that. And this is what happened. My views were changing while I was in seminary because, you know, we were really getting intensive, not only in the theology of covenantal reform, theology, but also combined with our very in-depth study of the entire Bible, which, of course, included the prophets. Now, interestingly, the professor that taught the class on Revelation, it was part of his class that he taught, he was a historical pre-mill, and that was interesting. You know, I had to respectfully disagree with him. But I do remember saying at one point that the position you take falls down to how you view one chapter in the Bible. Revelation 20. Your position on the millennium, he was saying, comes down to that. But that wasn't my experience, though. My experience was that it was not Revelation 20 that put me on the track to amillennialism, or realized millennialism, as really is a better definition. Rather, my conclusions towards amillennialism, they came from my other studies. My other studies of the scripture led to an amillennial understanding. And then when I come to Revelation 20, it fits that understanding, is how I understand basically the Lord's redemptive historical works in history are playing out. Now, perhaps the most influential book I read, which probably what solidified my position, view was Anthony Hocum's book, The Bible in the Future. The Bible in the Future, who presents a brilliant argument for amillennialism. And I read that, and everything seemed to click in place as far as I was concerned. And so after that, basically I ruled out the pre- and post-millennial views as unconvincing. Unconvincing. That's where it was for me at that point. And, well, my views on the dating of Revelation, however, did not change. And they have not changed. So now my position was a partial preterist amillennial. And I know these titles, you're probably going, what? I hope that the intent is to study what all this means. I'm just kind of giving you up the front. As we go along, I want to explain to you what all this means. But I'm just trying to come to the point, show where I'm at and kind of how I got there. So Jay Adams, of course, I pointed out his book there. He's probably the most well-known holder of that particular position, writing The Time of the End, which is a very good book, although I do think he misses the mark on his identification of the harlot. Anyway, over the course of my D-Men studies, several years later at Erskine Seminary, which I completed in 2014, I delved deeply, deeply into the overall scriptural teachings of the kingdom of God. And this only confirmed what I thought about the millennium, my conclusions there. And the kingdom of God is essentially the rule of God. Jesus reigns right now. He reigns right now. And thus the millennium, a symbolic term, per Revelation 20, is going on right now. Because Jesus is reigning right now. And it will continue until he brings the consummation of his kingdom. And that, as what we think of as the second coming, the parousia. So post-mill folks will agree with this, what I just said, for the most part. I mean, we'll agree with this. Because the difference really between post-millennials and amillennials is how we see the nature of the kingdom being made up during that time, particularly as it gets closer to when Jesus comes. And I won't go into that tonight, but that's kind of the difference. Now, studying this view has its challenges, the partial preterist amillennial view. It's because partial preterists typically lean towards postmillennialism, like was what I leaned towards, going into seminary. And then, while there are a lot of amillennials out there, most of them these days, at least the published ones, they hold to a later dating of Revelation. So it's unusual in a way to have an early day amillennial position. There are a few books out there that hold this position. There are quite a few folks that have this position. Just as far as published, we're kind of dearth for material. Another one is by Robert Hilligans. Where is it? I'm pretty sure I brought it. The Early Date of Revelation in the End Times. This one's pretty good. He was actually a mathematician, and his writing is not as smooth as somebody who's a professional, theologian, communicator, pastor. It does take a little bit of mining, but there's some real good information in there in that book. And well, of course, R.C. Sproul, his book is some people classify him as an amillennial. He never, as I'm aware of, held that or called himself that, although if you study his work, I can see where people get the conclusion that he was. Anyway, while I'm still looking, I have not found any in-depth, verse-by-verse commentaries holding to the early date, partial preterist Amill with some idealist tendencies view. And you can imagine how frustrating that is. Maybe what I'm doing right now, it may lead to something like that. I don't know. Maybe not. And I confess, it's pretty frustrating. Indeed, whenever I read an introduction in a commentary on Revelation, I've read a lot of them. When I read one by an Amill scholar, I generally will end up sighing when I find that they hold to a late date. I mean, the reasons are typically unconvincing. And I've yet to find one whose reasons are, obviously, because Gentry's book crushes them. Crushes them. I mean, they come across looking naive because his book is so solid. And to be honest, I'm disappointed with a few of these folks because I think they can do better. These are brilliant men who are learned. And I wonder why. I mean, they give the same argument. It's like they repeat the same arguments, but okay. The thing is, the dating of Revelation is extremely important what you hold. Because if you hold a late date, you're going to view everything in that book differently than if you hold an early date. You just are. And so from Revelation 1:1, from my point of view, they're off base. Now they may say I'm off of base from their point of view, but we have a little bit different views there. And the reason is for a person who holds an Amill position while holding to a later date of Revelation, logically they seem to be put in a position to have little choice, actually, but to take up the position of an idealist. And if we have time, hopefully we'll be discussing later what an idealist is. I'm trying to get us there. But they really don't have a whole lot of choice but to take up an idealist position in their interpretation, which is typical of their commentaries, although there are some historicist understandings out there, and hopefully we can look at those tonight too, what historicists mean. Those are exceptions. The idealism, it's a position that, in my opinion, is strong. It's strong when it comes to contemporary relevant application. So if you're doing a Bible study, you know, just a little short, quick Bible study, you don't want to get into the details, an idealist position is pretty good because there's these timeless principles that are drawn from it that make for good application in the now. I mean, but if you're going in depth, with a late date base, idealism, at least in my opinion, is flawed because it's not grounded in the historical realities of the original audience. I mean, a foundational hermeneutical, that's an interpretive, basically, principle of study in Scripture is that who is it written to? I mean, it's when we study Romans, the fact that we know that it's Paul writing to the Romans helps us to understand the book, because then what he says makes sense in the context of the first century Roman period when he wrote it. Now, if he was writing to another city or even Rome, 50 years later, we might have a little bit different way of viewing Romans. I mean, it's that way with Revelation. It's extremely important up front to have an idea of who the people were that were being written to in the time that they lived in, especially with in between those two times such a monumental event of AD 70 with the destruction of Jerusalem. So, I think I already told you my opinion, but Mark, go ahead and hit it. Orthodox preterist. What's the next one? Realized millennials. Okay, that's only the last slide has it, but I don't do that every slide. So I'm just anyway. But next slide there, Mark. Thank you. That's the point of view from that I'm going to be teaching and preaching from Revelation, and I admit that the partial aspect, it does leave some room to utilize some other interpretive methods. See, partial preterist means that you're not full preterist. It kind of opens up the door for touching on the strengths of other methods of interpretation. In other words, the historicist, the futurist, and the idealist, as they each have their strengths. And like I was telling Emily earlier today, you don't want to throw the whole baby out with the bathwater. Use the strengths of the interpretive methods that are out there. And we'll see how that looks as we go along. But there's this great quote by Anthony Hokama. Go ahead. You already got it up. Sorry. You already got it up. And by the way, Anthony Hokama, I unreservedly recommend every book he's written. That man is awesome. Anthony Hokama. I recommend everything he's written. So here's this quote from Anthony Hokama that I think is very helpful. Since the book of Revelation was addressed to the church of the first century AD, its message had reference to events occurring at that time and was therefore meaningful for the Christians of that day. But since the book was also intended for the church through the ages, its message is still relevant for us today. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? That's kind of the direction we're going. Now, Hokama, as I read him, I think he was more of a late dater. But his views still, that's a very sound statement, I think, of how to understand Revelation. You know, Revelation is an epistle. Talked about this morning. Revelation is an epistle. It's a letter. It's a letter. And so we want to treat it similarly to how we treat any letter as we read it in the Scriptures. There's same principles of understanding that go on. You know, the application is, you know, as we read it directly to the original recipient's situation there with truths that speak to us today. And that's what Hokama is saying. I mean, there's found specific fulfillment, but many general applications. Now, it would be a mistake to just put me in a box now and seal it up and say, okay, that's what he holds to. That would be a mistake. Now, you know, you can label me. I just labeled myself, I guess. But the thing is, there's just not an abundance of published material putting forth this exact position. And from what I've found, the folks that hold to similar positions, we diverge a bit. In our understanding. So as we go along, please just take it as it comes, because I'm probably going to be surprised a little bit on how I come down on certain particular issues. They're big issues that I'm very certain on. But as we dig through it, preaching through it and teaching, I think there's going to be some eureka moments, definitely for me and hopefully for you also. You know, I've got this general framework. There's a general framework based on a pre-AD 70 date of writing and my view of Christ Jesus' kingdom. And that's the foundation, you know, that's foundational in my understanding. How I understand the kingdom of God and when and to whom it was first written. You know, so I got to mention it as I preach through this. I'm going to be preaching it as I understand this. And I'm only going to really only touch on the other views as a means for clarification and correction, and perhaps a little bit of humor. We had some people laugh when I mentioned the helicopters this morning from chapter 9. Have y'all heard that before? Yeah. Okay, so.
I believed it before.
Huh?
I believed it.
You believed it before. Yeah, well.
Not now.
Yeah. But, so anyway, in the sermons, like I mentioned this morning, that's more going to be the face of the clock. Looking at the clock, what does the time say? What is it saying? And I think that bringing in all this extra information would just kind of confuse things in the sermons. Now, sermons are a different type of communication than what we're doing right now. And I am going for concise, describing the dollar bill as I understand it, rather than showing the various other counterfeits, I hate to say, but it's an illustration. Look on YouTube if you really want to dig into those. YouTube is a great source. There are all sorts of people out there who express their views. So in the evening service, though, I do think we'll get in a little more of the weeds on this, looking at different views. I think it's necessary to be able to look at the different views and do a comparison, scriptural studies, kind of see where the scriptures are going with the views and kind of do an analysis and look at it. So that way we come to an understanding, not just Roger said so, but more we've looked at it. And so we can see how this makes sense. All right. So next slide there. All right. Yeah, there you go. Some recommended reads. Y'all probably can y'all read that? Can y'all maybe some recommended reads. Not as, I mean, this is a good slide, but I'm not going to spend a whole lot on it. If y'all want, when we get towards the end, I can put this back up so you can basically copy off of it if you would like there. All right, so next slide there, Mark, please. All right, so when it comes to understanding Revelation, like I mentioned, perhaps the most or one of the most important things up front to decide is whether Revelation has an early date or a late date. Early, of course, being mid-60s during the end of Nero's reign. Later date being circa 80, 95, 96 during Domitian's reign. So the significance, impact of this decision, Sam Storms, he states it pretty well here. And oh, by the way, he's not a preterist. I mean, this is a guy, he wrote an excursus in one of his books about, you know, the attractiveness of preterism, but he says he's not convinced. But he says, if it's true, this is what it means. This is the significance of such a thing. So, if the preterist, AD 70, or AD pre-70 composition of the book of Revelation can be substantiated, all the judgments portrayed through the imagery of seven seals, seven trumpets, and seven bowls must be taken as descriptive of God's wrath against apostate Israel during the siege by the Roman armies, 66 to 70, which resulted in the utter destruction of both the city of Jerusalem and its temple. Did you catch that? That's pretty different than most of probably what you're hearing out there, at least I know in popular eschatology circles. I mean, think about it. You know, the imagery of the seven seals, the seven trumpets, the seven bowls, taken as descriptive of God's wrath against apostate Israel, basically as it came down upon them and the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, remember those of y'all who were here for the Olivet Discourse sermons? Does that sound familiar? What Jesus was saying in the Olivet Discourse? Yeah. Yeah. What's that?
Wormwood.
Huh?
Wormwood.
We'll get to that when we get there. We'll get to that. Not going there tonight. We'll get there eventually, Lord willing. So tonight, I'm not going to be able to get into the proofs of the pre-AD 70 dating. Maybe next week, maybe the week after that. But the proofs are out there, and they're very, very, very good. The internal evidence for a pre-AD 70 writing is extremely strong, extremely strong. And the external evidence is also it's there. I mean, the internal evidence is stronger, admittedly. And the people who hold to a late date, generally they point to one guy, and he is controversial. And to be honest with you, I don't even think they're looking at a good translation of what he has to say, or at least they're translating right. But you know, there some people say it'll go either way. But if any of the question on it makes it questionable, and so you would look at the internal evidence, which is what it says in the book, and from what it says in the book to help come to the conclusion of when it was written. And we'll look at that, Lord willing, if not next week, you know, in a few weeks. So I want to look, first of all, before we go there, I want to look at four typical approaches to interpretation for Revelation. The historicist, the idealist, the futurist, and the preterist. And we probably will not get to all of them as we got a little bit of time, but we're probably not going to get through it all tonight. Basically, I want to look at some definitions given by just some select scholars out there. I want to look at some definitions. And then I want to have some discussion on them, because I know that on each of these positions, we've probably been exposed to them at some point. And perhaps, you know, you're questioning on where we're going on this. So next slide, please, Mark. All right. So historicist, this is of the four interpretational things. Did y'all catch that? There's the historicist. Okay. You've got the idealist. Right. You've got the futurist, and you've got the preterist. Okay, the first one that we're going to look at is the historicist. And here's some definitions here. Michael Wilcock, interesting interesting guy here. He's an amillennialist idealist who favors a late date. And this is what he says about the historicist. It's a chart of the whole of history from Christ's first coming to his second and beyond. And that's actually pretty concise, pretty good. A chart of the whole of history from Christ's first coming to his second and beyond. And then Leon Morris there, he's an amill, and he calls himself a modified idealist, basically similar to, anyway, but I won't go into that. But he's got a little partial pre and a little partial futurism in how he looks at it. And I really like Leon Morris's commentary. If you want a good commentary, I would recommend his. And he says, those who see the book this way claim that it is an inspired forecast of the whole of human history. They see its symbols as setting out in broad outline the history of Western Europe and as stretching right on until the second coming of Christ. And you see, can you understand that? If you've got an ESV study Bible, and I recommend this one, I've recommended time and time before, the notes in here are amazing. And Dennis Johnson, he actually puts these in here, and he has charts explaining these in the beginning before you get to Revelation. So if you've got an ESV study Bible, you can go here. Dennis Johnson, he does a great job explaining these. Although I'm pretty sure he's an amill idealist, the guy who wrote the study notes for that. But so y'all understand what those are saying. All right, so the next slide there. There, Mark. So, a gentleman by the name of Robert Mounts, brilliant scholar, by the way, brilliant scholar. He is a representative of the historic pre-mill school. And he's a kind of a preterist futurist look. And he has this interesting statement in his commentary that John could have been a preterist, historicist, futurist, and idealist. Which is why I like the idea of leaving it open a little bit for the strengths on these things. And Mounts, by the way, he was a naval pilot in World War II. Now, he passed away last year, but awesome man. And he says this: the historicist interpreted it as a forecast of the course of history leading up to his own time. Leading up to his own time. Kim Riddleberger, he's an amill, he's not a preterist, probably an idealist. I haven't really pinned him down exactly, but historicism is the traditional Protestant interpretation that stresses the identification of Babylon the Great with the city of Rome. Y'all know the harlot there, the Babylon the Great on the forehead and everything, okay? So they look, the city of Rome, they see that as being how those things relate there. And the next slide there, Mark, please.
Hey, Roger.
Yes.
Who is the his referring to?
Go back. Huh?
Who is the his?
Wait, I think, no, go back, Mark. Go back.
No.
No, you're going wrong.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go.
His own time, who is his?
Third line down.
Robert Mounts.
Oh, the historicist, interpreted as a forecast of the... His, that would be the historicist. You know, the person who's actually doing the interpretation. So it could be his or her, but he, you know, just said his. So yeah, that would be interpreted according to their own time. Say you're a historicist. As of right now, you would see it a forecast of history leading up to our time. You would see a lot of its fulfillments all through history up to your time. So y'all tracking on that? So it makes sense? Okay, so next slide there. Okay, so... that's kind of small, right? Can y'all read that? I know it's big, but so George Eldon Ladd, he's got quite a lot of really good writing out there, although it's kind of difficult to read, but very good. He was a historic pre-mill, he's a historic pre-mill preterist/futurist, and this way he says this perspective views Revelation as a symbolic prophecy of the entire history of the church down to the return of Christ and the end of the age. The numerous symbols of the book designate various historical movements and events in the Western world and the Christian church. Notice Western world, and that's consistent with the historicists. they seem to point to things going on in the Western world. What about the rest of the world? But okay, and the Christian church. One of the prevailing features of this interpretation has been the view that the beast is the Roman papacy and the false prophet the Roman church. And this view was so widely held that for a long time it was called the Protestant view. Yeah, y'all familiar with the Westminster Confession? All the Presbyterians are, at least. At one point, it used to have in there that the Pope was the Antichrist. That was coming from this point of view. Now, they took that out of there because they realized that's not good. They took that out of the Westminster, but at one point it was in there because that's what the Protestants, you know, of that time when they wrote that, that's what they thought. And so next slide there, Mark. So on this one, Kenneth L. Gentry, this is the guy who wrote this book that I told you about, Before Jerusalem Fell, which is awesome. So he, post-mill, partial preterist guy, he said, the historicist applies Revelation's many judgment scenes to various national wars, cultural revolutions, and religious movements, such as the rising of Roman Catholicism, the Inquisition, the outbreak of the Protestant Reformation, the French Revolution, and World Wars I and II. And the various evil figures in Revelation are also applied to important historical persons such as the various popes, Charlemagne, Napoleon, Mussolini, or Hitler. You see why they call it historicist. They want to ground it in kind of how history's been going along, and they want to see this all, this is happening in history now. It's kind of the direction the historicists go. So Mark, next slide there. So a little bit of sum of the historicists. A forecast of the whole of history from Christ's first coming to his second and beyond. And also the numerous symbols of the book designate various historical movements and events in the Western world and the Christian church. All right. Y'all tracking on that? For those of y'all who don't know me too well, tracking means, what does it mean?
Following.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So next slide. So a little discussion on the historicist idea here. Now, have y'all run into this view before? Obviously, the Westminster Confession, for some of y'all who are familiar with that. Have you run into this view in your readings before? So I see seeing quite a few heads nod. You're familiar. Has it impacted you?
It's very common, I think.
You think this is pretty common?
Yeah.
Yeah. Among what circles, particularly?
Especially Baptists.
You think of Baptist circles?
I mean the Baptists that I've been associated
with. The Baptists you've been, okay. Yeah.
That's what I was taught as a Baptist.
That's what you were taught as a Baptist? Okay. Yeah, and Danny's nodding over there. What were you going to say, JT?
I was saying, I think there's a tendency to, if you just kind of read through Revelation and have the view, you're not very familiar with it. You tend to, if you're influenced by what's going on in the world, and people say, oh, this is prophecy, you're going to naturally try to associate what you see there as something that's happened already. And I think there's a tendency to do that, particularly in people who haven't really delved in very deeply to the study of Revelation or the rest of the Bible, actually.
So just a cursory reading without digging into all the history around it and everything could lead to this. Is that what you're saying?
I think it could.
Yeah. Yes, Dick.
I remember watching Jack Ben Impey with my kids, and they were scared of death, man. But none of this stuff came true.
None of it came true.
Right. And so they are down on,
yeah.
You know.
You know, are you talking about historicists or futurists? Because the futurists are the ones who say it's going to come on this date, you know, kind of thing.
You know, he was always saying, you know, send me your money and, you know, get this.
Oh,
yeah. It's going to happen this year. Man.
Yeah. This book has been, I mean, throughout the history of church, this book has been manipulated for people's personal things. I mean, one of the reasons Eusebius, father of church history, if you're familiar with him, Eusebius really didn't like the book of Revelation. Matter of fact, at that point, the canon wasn't really solid. He was early 4th century when he wrote it. They were still hammering out, making sure what books. Revelation wasn't really officially in the canon at that point. So he really didn't like it because there were some folks out there who were using it, you know, coming up with some, like, really scary stuff, and it was causing a lot of problems in the church. And so he backed off on it a little bit, but yeah, that's been going on throughout history. People will abuse this book. It should not be abused.
I mean, I'm sorry. I'm even sorry that I exposed my kids to this guy, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, it's part of the learning process, David. I mean, we have to be exposed to different things so we can evaluate it and then look at the truth of the Scriptures and do our own studies, pray that the Spirit of God will work in us and help reveal it to us, and then come to conclusions. We've got to come to different views. One of the reasons we have doctrine is because there were so many heresies that came along the way. And because of the heresies that would come up, the church would go, wait a second, that ain't right. And so a doctrine would develop and as a result of, you know, against the heresy. That's part of how we've gotten doctrine in our church, was from things that people saw and through that. So, all right. What are some strengths and some weaknesses? Some strengths and some weaknesses, perhaps, that you see in the historicist. And if you want to go back a slide there, Mark, so that they can see the sun. What are some strengths and some weaknesses, perhaps, that may come to you that just off the top of your head or just from your studies of the historicist view?
They tend to force history puzzle to fit with it.
So they try to force history, you know, to fit with it. I think that's very well put.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're laying out this puzzle and they go, I'm not in the trim a little bit, but we'll get it fit.
But we'll get it to fit. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's pretty good. What else? What else?
I think there may be some who are trying to encourage other people that these prophecies are true by them saying, see, this happened right here. That happened over there. And it may be a well-intentioned effort to try to convince people that the Bible is true.
Well, you know, that's a good point. I mean, it's so widespread, and it's been going on for pretty much the whole history of the church, that there's got to be some human tendencies there to want to make it fit, because you want to understand it, and you look at the world around you, you're like, well, that fits. Mm-hmm. That fits. And maybe it does. Maybe it does.
Kind of fits.
Kind of fits. Kind of fits.
Would there be more of a temptation to interpret things in Revelation literally that are actually symbolic?
That's more the futurists, and we're not going to get to them tonight, but that's more the futurists have a tendency to do that, like the helicopters. Like the helicopters, yeah. So, strengths and weaknesses, we've talked a few. I'll just run through a few real quick. Strengths. The view does indeed make Revelation meaningful for this generation. At raid any part, you know. Here it points to this, so it does that. It is a strengthening of faith to see the whole of history as under the control of God, which we believe that is a doctrinal truth. You know, and that seems to be a strength of this. The whole of history is under the control of God. Now, weakness, you know, because by the way, if you want to think of a theme for Revelation, victory. There you go. One word. Victory. That is Revelation.
Yeah.
Victory. Okay. So we have this. So all right. So also weaknesses here. The early Christians could not have got much out of a book whose concern was basically for later periods. For them, most of the book on this view must have been an insoluble puzzle. They'd have been going, why is this being read to this if it really doesn't have anything to do with us? You know, Mounts, he says this, of little significance to its initial readers, the Apocalypse was held to sketch the history of Western Europe through the various popes, the Protestant Reformation, the French Revolution, individual leaders such as Charlemagne and Mussolini. And the point of that is, what about the rest of the world? There's a lot of history going on. What about that? Because people want to, I mean, so it's got a Western, you know, even a Western European you know, central focus going on there as far as how that's been interpreted. That's certainly problematic. George Eldon Ladd, he said this, "This view has little to commend it, for the Revelation would in that case have little to say to the churches of Asia to which it was addressed." And that goes back to the dating that I was talking about there. So we're going to have to stop there because basically we're out of time.
I was going to say one thing. Historians, they often pick out the beast throughout history.
The beast has occurred a lot.
Another beast, Hitler, Mussolini, like you said.
But one thing that I think we're going to see is what we've got on the beast is there's a fulfillment, but it foreshadows, kind of like beast, because there's characteristics to the beast, and I do think we see a foreshadowing through history, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later, but we need to move on. Before we do, any particular questions out there that you might have at this point? David.
You haven't hit my view.
I haven't gotten your view yet. Okay. So.
Ag mill? Yeah,
worry about that. Don't know anything about ag mill. I'm sure you'll tell me. Agnostic mill.
Ag.
Oh, you're talking about the pan mill.
Yeah.
It'll pan out in the end. I've heard that one. Yeah. Jesus wins. All right, so we got to stop there.